wizard rise onto his toes and start to raise his hands as he moved out to get the man from behind. Then Fish was pushing into the house, supporting the wizard, kicking the door shut behind him. He saw Smeds, was surprised. He started lowering the wizard to the floor. "How did you get in so fast?" Smeds looked at the dead man. "Open side window." "How come you did it that way?" The handle of a long knife stuck out under the wizard's chin. There was not much blood. Blade went straight into the brain. No chance for him to do any witch stuff while he was dying. Smed stared at the body. Now he understood the plan. Fish had sent him around back, just to get him out of the way. "You all right? How do you feel? A little shaky?"
"I'm all right.
I don't feel much of anything at all." Did he keep written accounts or records? Something where he might have put down something about Timmy.
"I don't know. I never saw him do it while we were here."
"We'd better look. You start. You feeling something now?"
"Just feeling sorry for that woman after they find him."
"Yeah. Be rough for her for a while. Look around. Try not to mess things up too much, and don't take too long. We gotta get out of here." Fish went to the room where the wizard had done his interviews. Smeds rejoined him 5 minutes later, carrying a large glass jar and a couple of books.
"What the hell is that?"
"Timmy's hand. I found it in a room in the back. All kinds of weird stuff back there."
"Shit. I'm glad we took time to look."
He'd picked out a few books himself.
"Let's get the hell out of here and get rid of this stuff. Out the window. We pull it shut. It'll latch itself behind us. I'll go first, see if it's clear."
Smeds's hands shook as he poured the first mug of beer. But it had not been as hairy as he had thought it would be. Still, there was some reaction. More than old man Fish was showing. The hand and books had been cared for. The most dangerous strand had been clipped. Only one thing left to do. Their benefactor, the Night Stalker Corporal, came in with his beer bucket, beamed around, went for a refill.
"Shit!" Smed said. "I clean forgot. I had a date tonight."
Fish gave him a few seconds of a commiserating look, then said, "Drink up, catch a nap. We got half the job still to do."
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook, so please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
And now, part two of The Silver Spike, written by Glenn Cook and read by Jonathan Davis.
Chapter 36. It seemed like I never saw Darling do much to deserve her White Rose reputation. Maybe that was because she was so unglamorous when you saw her. Just a scruffy, tangle-haired blonde broad in her 20s who would have fit right in with the gang back at the potato ranch. Except that she would have looked a lot more worn out now because she would have been dropping kids for 10 years. Besides her being deaf and dumb, which is always hard for the rest of us to keep separate from stupid, I think it's hard to take her serious because she does what she does so easily, so casually. Take that attack on the monastery. Slicker than greased owl shit. And no one would have gotten hurt at all if that monster toad killer dog hadn't come plopping into the middle of those centaurs when he was making a run for it. And that was their damned fault. They got too eager. If they was hanging back like they was supposed to,
they would have had time to get out of the way. She sure had the respect of the tree god and all the pull with him she wanted. I think he'd indulge her in anything. She don't put on no airs, neither. It was strange for a while. You had Darlin' in one spot with Silent always close, trying to stay between her and Bowman's and her and Raven at the same time, only Raven and the wizard would not get anywhere near each other because they did not trust each other any more than Silent trusted either of them. It was all kind of amusing. Because when you're in the back of a monster a couple of miles up in the air, sharing that back with a couple hundred critters that would have you for breakfast if you don't behave, you sure as shit ain't going to get away with nothing, no matter what you'd like to try. The Torque boys knew that. I knew it. Darlin knew it. But those other three geniuses, Bowman's, Raven, and Silent, were so busy being important, plugging up the knot hole at the center of the universe, that never occurred to them. The Torques were a little nervous about me, though. I used to be guards, and they was black company. They thought I might be lugging a grudge. But I was saying the White Rose don't put on no airs, not even being the White Rose. She don't like being called anything but darling. She didn't mind when I came round trying to talk to her. Only Raven and Silent minded. I told Raven to stuff it when he objected, and I guess she gave Silent the same message. He didn't do nothing but stand around looking like he was making up his mind where to start carving when I talked to her. Mind you, these were grown men. Plenty older than me. It was Raven's fault I could talk to her at all. He had only himself to blame. It was him insisted I learn the sign language so we could communicate in situations where we couldn't talk out loud. Not that we talked much at first, Darlin' and me. Just hi, how you doing stuff. I wasn't very good at it. She taught me more signs as we went along. She didn't come right out and say it, but I got the feeling she was starved for somebody to talk to besides Silent. She couldn't say it, with him hovering over her like he did all the time. When I started out, the only thing I was really wanting to find out was what she really thought about Raven. I wanted to keep him from making any more of a fool of himself than he already had. Maybe she figured that. She was sharp. She never gave me a chance to work it in. So, after a couple of days, we were talking about what it was like being country kids growing up with a war going on all around. It was easy to understand why she had gone the way she had. Everybody knew the story, so she didn't need to explain. I told her I joined up to get away from the farm, and from where I stood back then, the rebels didn't look no cleaner than the Imperials. Maybe less because she hadn't come along to start cleaning them up yet. And the Imperials got paid. Good. And on time. She didn't seem offended, so I added my secret philosophy of life. Any dork who became a soldier for an idea instead of the money deserved to die for his country. If you're going to put it all on the table, six up with some other guy, it damned well better be for stakes you can carry away. That did offend her. It got scorching for a few minutes, then sort of settled down to a sustained low heat, her trying to convince me that they were abstractions worth fighting and dying for, and me clinging to my position that no matter how admirable the cause, there was no point getting killed for it, because even only 20 years down the road, nobody was going to remember you or give a rat's ass if they did. 2 days went by that way. I got a feeling that if there hadn't been so much ego getting in the way, Raven and Silent would have ganged up on me for hanging around with their girlfriend. She was easy to talk to. I let out things I never said before, because I thought they had no value, considering the source. Stuff about how people in the world worked like that. I never realized my outlook was so cynical.
till I tried to tie it up and put it across in that unsubtle way you have to use with sign. I told her I could not believe in her movement, because it did not promise anything for the future except freedom from the tyranny of the past. I told her that what little philosophy I detected driving the movement totally ignored human nature. That if the rebels ever did manage to topple the empire, whatever replaced it would be worse. That was the lesson of history. New regimes, to make sure they survived, were always nastier than the ones before them. I kept after the theme of what did the rebels offer in place of the empire. In my limited experience, the people of the empire were more secure, prosperous, and industrious than they had been before its coming, except in areas where there was an active rebel presence. I told her that for the great mass of people, freedom wasn't an issue at all, that it was an alien concept, at least as her rebels seemed to define it. I told her that for a peasant, and peasants probably make up 3/4 of the population, freedom meant being able to provide for a family and market any surpluses. When I left home, the potato fields and the rest of it were held communally. The work was long and hard and boring, but no one ever went hungry, and even in the lean years, there were surpluses enough to provide for a few little luxuries. In my grandfather's time, though, our fields had been just one more parcel among scores owned by one great landholder. The people who lived there were part of the furniture, like the trees and water and game, legally bound to the land. They had any number of obligations to the Lord that had to be fulfilled before they could work the land. And of the product of the land, they had to hand over fixed amounts to the landholder. First, if it was a bad year, the Lord could take everything. But they had not had to walk in the lady's dark shadow. So they must have been blissfully happy little farm animals. I told her that the sons of the landholders were all backbones of the rebel cause now, determined to liberate their enslaved homelands. I told her I had no illusions about the lady having any love or concern for the common people. She obliterated existing ruling classes, simply to be rid of potential challenges to her own power. She had plenty of disgusting minions whose assigned domains were terrible places to be. Finally, I argued that the empire was in no danger of falling apart, despite the fact that she had disarmed the lady during the showdown in the Barrowland. The lady had been obsessed with expanding her borders and the reach of her power. She had created an efficient machine to handle the domestic work of the empire. That machine had not been broken. We had been in the air 4 days. Evening was coming on, and ahead, brown gave way to the hazy blue of the Sea of Torments. We had come a long way in a short time. When I thought about all the shit me and Raven went through to get down there to that monastery dam, this was the only way to travel. I left off arguing with Darlin. I felt a little guilty. As that day had gone on, she had argued back less and less. I think I was throwing a lot of stuff at her that she probably hadn't ever thought about. On a smaller scale, I've always known people for whom a goal was everything, who never thought about the consequences of the goal achieved. Of course, I did what everybody else does. I underestimated the hell out of her. Next day, I didn't run into her till around noon. I guess I was avoiding her. But when I did see her, she had bounced back. About the same time, I noticed the dark loom of land on the northern horizon, and right afterward realized we were losing altitude. The wind whales were sliding into some kind of formation. A triangle above with us below. Mantas were taken to the air, gliding toward the coast. I asked her in sign, "Where are we? What is happening?"
she replied, also in sign, we are approaching Opal. We are going to find Raven's children. We are going to compel him to confront his past. That was a measure of how much the tree god valued and respected her. Though he had yanked his minions away from that monastery and had ordered them to scurry north because there was no time to lose, he would let her interrupt the journey for this, because it was important to her. I figured Raven didn't know what was coming. He'd probably need a lot of support when it hit him in. I went looking for him. Chapter 37. There was nothing out at the fourth hour, Smeds reflected. The soldiers were all off somewhere, loafing, because the bad boys all had sense enough to be home in bed. The bakers had not yet stumbled out to their doughs and ovens. The only sound in the street was that of the drizzle falling, of the water dripping from the roofs. He and Fish made no noise. Fish seemed not to be breathing. There would be one problem with this one they had not faced with the other. He had seen them both before. On the other hand, they were making their move at this ungodly hour, reasonably expecting to catch him in his bed. Breaking in should be easy, from what they recalled of the physician's place. The deed itself would have to be done quietly. There was, they suspected, a live-in housekeeper. They did not want to add her to their weight of conscience.
There it is, Smed said.
Like the wizard, the physician was prosperous enough to occupy his own freestanding combination home and place of business. The structure was barely a decade old. A few years before it had been built, that part of town had burned during an outbreak of violence between rebel sympathizers and mercenaries in the Imperial service. The middle class had come in to build homes upon the graves of tenements.
Front door to the house and door to the office. Fish murmured. Assume a back door. These places all have a little fenced-in garden behind them. Three windows we can see. I'm surprised vandals haven't destroyed that leaded glass monstrosity.
The physician's office was scabbed onto the side of his home, set a little back. It had its own little porch and door, and beside the door, a marvelously dramatic floor-to-ceiling leaded glass window, 6 feet wide.
Go, Fish said.
Smets dashed across and crouched in the slightly deeper shadow beneath the window on the building's right front. His thoughts about the weather were not polite. He was miserable enough, without a soaking drizzle added on for frosting. Fish came across as Smeds rose to test the window. He was not surprised to find it tightly secured. Fish went to the house door, achieved no better result. Smeds crossed behind him and checked the second front window. Solid. He slid around the corner of the house. Fish was crouched in front of the office door, which he had pushed open about 3 inches. Smeds joined him, his knife sliding into his hand.
It was unlocked.
Yes. I don't like it.
Maybe it's so clients can get in any time.
Fish ran his hand up the inside of the door.
Maybe, but there's a heavy latch catch. Let's be careful.
Careful is my middle name.
Fish pushed the door open, looked inside.
Clear.
He slipped in. Smeds followed, headed for the door connecting with the house. It was unlocked, too. It opened toward him. He pulled. It swung smoothly, soundlessly. He heard a faint snick behind him as Fish closed the latch. He saw nothing suspicious in the room before him. He stepped inside.
Maybe it was a whisper of cloth in motion. Maybe it was a little intake of breath. Maybe it was both.
Whatever, Smed spun down and away. A line of fire sliced across his shoulder blade. He landed on his knees, facing the office, watching a shape collide with Fish. Fish said, "Shit!" At the same moment, the shape squealed. Then it threw itself sideways and floundered through the leaded glass window, a step ahead of Smed's. Fish came to the window. That was him. He was expecting us. Too damned smart. Figured too much out. Can't let him get away. Fish jumped through the window. The physician was going for all he was worth, legs and arms flailing. That fat little hedgehog was no sprinter. Smeds followed Fish. He passed the older man moments later and gained steadily on his prey, who had gotten a 60-yard head start. The physician glanced back once, stumbled. Smeds gained 10 yards while he was getting his balance. Fear lent him renewed stamina and speed. He stayed the same distance ahead for half a minute. The physician knew he was not going to outrun anyone. Smeds knew he knew that. Unless he was running in a blind panic, he had developed a strategy, had chosen an ultimate destination. The physician zigged right into a narrow alleyway. Smed slowed, approached cautiously. Footfalls pounded away in the darkness. He went after them. He was just as careful rounding another corner, again without need. Gods, it was dark in there. Third corner. He stopped dead. There were no sounds of flight. He tried listening for heavy breathing, but could not be sure he heard anything because his own intruded too much. What now? Nothing to do but go forward. He dropped down and advanced in a careful duck walk. His muscles protested. He was grateful for the toughening they had gotten in the great forest. There. Was that breathing? Couldn't tell for sure. The echoes of Fisher's approach overrode it. Scrape, swish. What must have been a foot missed his face by a fraction of an inch. He flung himself forward, but the physician was already moving again. Smeds's knife ripped along his hip. Smeds went down, hard, but caught hold of a heel and managed to hang on. He snaked forward, stabbing at the man's calf, his target invisible in the darkness. The man squealed like an injured rabbit. Smeds was so startled, he let go. Then he realized he was letting his man get away. He got up and charged again, smashed into the man. Please! I won't tell anyone! I swear! Pain slashed along Smeds's ribs on this left side. He flailed away with his knife, hitting anything he could. The physician tried to scream and fight back and run away all at the same time. Smeds held on with one hand, kept hacking with the other. The physician pulled him out into a street. Smeds kept hacking. The physician collapsed. Fish arrived. Shit, Smeds. Shit. Got him. You sure he didn't get you too? Smeds looked at himself. He was covered with blood. Some of it was his own. Somebody yelled up the street. People had begun coming to stoops and windows. Fish bent, slashed the physician's throat, said, "We've got to get out of here. There'll be soldiers here in a minute." He looked at the dead man's hand. "Ah, oh, a mess. He touched you with that?"
"I don't think so."
"Come on." Fish offered him a hand. "You make it?"
"I'm all right for now."
Fish headed back into the alley. Smeds began feeling it as soon as the excitement began to go out of him. He knew he would not be able to get away if a chase developed. Instead of making for the Skull and Crossbones, Fish headed into the West End.
"Where are we going?"
Smeds asked.
reservoir, get you cleaned up. We take you home looking like that, the Gray Boys are going to be around to ask what happened before you can get your boots off.
Chapter 38.
I don't know what I expected to see when we got to Opal. Maybe nothing changed from my last time there. I sure wasn't ready for the mess we found. I gaped incredulously as we glided over the ruins, where a few survivors scurried around like frightened mice. I went and told Darlin. Don't look to me like there's much chance we'll find the people you want. Odds never bothered Darlin. Raven and Silent now had especially black feelings for me. I had the gall to tell Darlin who she had to find if she wanted to force Raven to face his past. Neither of them wanted that to happen. Both of them were so busy thinking about themselves, they didn't have time to wonder what Darlin really thought or felt about anything. We crossed most of the city. Up north, we spied several large, neatly arranged camps. The tents were too numerous to be all army, but they showed us that the Imperials were there, responding to the destruction of the city in a quick, orderly fashion. Below, soldiers and civilians were at work, leveling way for the new. Though they stopped to gawk, these people did not run away. Darling ordered us to watch for the standard of the military commander. She figured that was the place to start, since the city was obviously under martial law. I couldn't figure why she thought she'd get any cooperation, though. I asked, "What do you feel about old Raven these days?" I was careful to keep my hands hid from him and Silent both. I figured she wouldn't understand what I meant. I was wrong. She signed, "Once I had a child's love for a man who saved me and nurtured me and risked everything to protect me, when, long before I could believe it myself, he recognized the role I would play in the struggle with the darkness. That child was like a very little girl in some ways. She was going to marry Daddy when she grew up, and it never occurred to her that things might not turn out that way till she tried to pursue it and to press it. I was never really a girl or a woman or a human being to Raven Case, even though he did awful things for me. I was a symbol, an expiation, and when I insisted on becoming a person, he did the only thing he could do to keep on serving the symbol and not have to deal with a flesh and blood woman. That's kind of how I always thought it was.
I signed. Many men admire Raven. He fears nothing concrete. He takes no crap from anyone. People who mess with him get hurt, and the hell with the consequences. But those are the only dimensions he has. They are the only dimensions he permits himself. How can I remain emotionally entangled with a man who will not allow himself emotions, however much he did for me in other ways? I appreciate him. I honor him. I may even revere him. But that's all anymore. He can't change that with some demonstration, like a boy hanging by his knees from a branch to impress a girl.
I grinned because I had a gut feeling that's exactly what Raven had in mind. Poor sucker. There just wasn't nothing left for him to win. And he wasn't the kind to accept that, even if she told him to his face point blank. I wanted to sneak in one or two about Silent, too, but I didn't get a chance. The military headquarters got spotted and the wind whale dropped down and moved up to it, anchored itself in place by dropping tentacles to grab rocks and trees. Its presence overhead was disconcerting to those in the camp. I like that word, disconcerting. I got it from Bowman's. Such a sly way to say they were having shit hemorrhages down there. There was a big hurrah, all kinds of whoop
and holler and carrying on, when a bunch of plane critters ganged up on the scar-faced stone and threw it over the side, almost into the lap of the command staff down there. Them old boys were pretty shook. I wondered how much more excited they would get if they knew the white rose her own self was right over their heads. But they wasn't going to try nothing, no matter what they knew. Who'd want to duke it out with four pissed-off wind whales? Which is what they would get if they wasn't polite. Scarstone popped back up. He talked. Silent translated for darling. I didn't hear anything. The Torque boys had let me know I was supposed to stay back, so I stayed back. Darlin made a bunch of signs that I guess the stone could see somehow. It went away. After a while, it came back. After four rounds of that, it didn't go away anymore. But the wind whale stayed where it was. So I guessed a deal had been struck. I went to try to talk it over with Raven. But he was in about as foul a mood as I ever saw. And anyway, he had pegged me for some kind of traitor, so I gave it up and went off to shoot the shit with the Torques and the Talking Buzzard and a couple other plane creatures that wasn't too shy. Darlin goes after something. She usually gets what she wants. This time she got it just before noon next day. A hurrah broke out downstairs. Darlin sent Scarstone to check it out. It came back and reported. She got up and walked over to Raven, who watched her like she was the hangman coming. She signed at him. He got up and followed her, again with the eagerness of a man headed for the gallows. I knew him well enough to see the signs. He was putting himself into a role. I tagged along, wondering what it would be. Most everybody else moved closer, too. Two young people around 20 came puffing up over the side of the wind whale. So the impossible was possible. The improbable a sure thing. Unless the army down there figured they could placate Darlin with a couple of ringers. The boy looked like Raven, 20 years younger. Same dark hair and coloration, same determined face, not yet hardened into grimness. I was only a step behind when Raven got his first look at them. He cursed softly, muttered, "She looks like her mother." It was plain they hadn't been told they were here for a family reunion. They were just puzzled and scared. Mostly scared. And more so as the mob closed in around them. They didn't recognize Raven. They did recognize Darlin, and that scared them even more. Everybody waited for somebody else to say something. Raven whispered, "Do something, Case." Desperately. "I'm lost." "Me? Hell, I don't even speak the lingo that good." "Case, help me out. Try to get this moving. I don't know what to do." "All right." I thought of a couple of suggestions for him, but I was never a guy who kicked crippled dogs. I went to work in my feeble Jewel City's dialect. "You have no idea why you were brought here, do you?" They shook their heads. "Relax. You ain't in no danger. We just want to ask about your ancestors. Especially your parents." The boy rattled something. "You'll have to talk slower, please." The girl said, "He said our parents are dead. We've been on our own since we were children." Raven winced. I figured the voice must be like that of his wife, too. Silent translated for darling, who really gave them the eye. Seeing they was Raven's kids, I didn't figure it was so amazing they pulled through. "What do you know about your parents?" The girl took on the answering chores. Maybe she thought her brother was too excitable.
"Very little."
She told me pretty much what I had been able to find out for myself when we were headed south. She did know that her mother had not been a nice person.
We have managed to live her down. Last year, we won a judgment that took some of our father's properties from her family and returned them to us. We expect to win more such judgments.
That was something, anyway. The girl had conjured up no special regard for the woman who had brought her into the world.
The boy said, I don't remember my mother at all. After our births, I think she had as little to do with us as she could. I remember nurses. She probably got what she deserved.
And your father?
I have vague memories of a very distant man who wasn't home much, but who did visit when he was, probably out of obligation and for appearance sake.
Do you have any special feeling about him now?
Why should we?
The girl asked.
We never really knew him, and he's been dead for 15 years.
I faced Darling, signed. Is there any point going on? She signed, yes.
Not for their sake, for his.
I asked Raven, you get anything to put in? No. He didn't. I could see him thinking maybe he was going to slide out of this after all. It wasn't going to be that easy. Darlin had me tell them that their father had not died, that he had been harried into exile by their mother's confederates. She had me hit the high spots of their years together. They had had time to get over being scared. Now, they were getting suspicious. The boy demanded, what the hell is going on?
How come these questions about our old man? He's history. We don't care. If he was to walk up right now and introduce himself, I'd say, so what? He'd be just another guy.
I signed to Darlin. You gonna keep pushing it? And asked Raven in Forsberger. You want to call his bluff? Negatives all around. Bunch of wimps. So Raven was going to slide out. I told his kids, your father was very important in the life of the White Rose. He was a stand-in parent for her for years, and she knew how it pained him to be in exile. She stopped here because she wanted to try to give back something of what she'd had and you couldn't. Neither Raven nor Darlin liked me saying that. I think the girl figured it out about then. She got real carefully interested in Raven, but she didn't say anything to her brother. I got Darlin to agree this was enough and our guests ought to be turned loose. She wasn't satisfied with the way things turned out. What the hell can you do with women? You can give them exactly what they ask for, and they'll cuss you because that ain't what they really want. Just before the girl went over the side, she turned and told me,
if my father was alive today, he wouldn't have to fear that he would be unwelcome in his daughter's house.
Then she went. All right. There was an open door, if ever I seen one. We took off the second the girl hit ground. Darlin wanted to get far away before word she was there got to somebody who could do something about it. We lit out northeast, like we was headed for the Plain of Fear. Chapter 39. Every day, more people came into Orr and nobody left. A pigeon could not get out. Several had died trying. Some elements of the population were growing restless. There were more fights than usual. More people ended up on the labor gangs. The searches went on and on and on. There was not a building in Orr that had not been tossed at least twice, not a citizen who had not been rousted. There were rumors of big tension in high places. Brigadier Wildbrand did not think she owed Gossamer and Spider Silk anything and resented having her Night Stalkers used as bullies for their personal benefit. They were elite troops, not political gangsters. The nature of the people entering the city changed with time. Fewer were farmers or traders. More and more were dire characters with no obvious trade. The news about the Silver Spike was spreading. Smeds didn't like it. It meant big trouble. How did Gossamer and Spider Silk expect to control all those witches and wizards, some of whom might be much more potent than they suspected? And the bullies they brought with them? Chaos threatened. Smeds understood the strategy. The twins meant to up the heat and pressure till the spike popped to the surface. If it came up in hands other than their own, they were confident they could take it away. Could they? Every witch and wizard in town knew that too. But they had come hunting anyway. Only Tully was pleased. He thought the situation perfect for the auction he wanted to run. "We gotta get the word out," he told the others over supper. "Keep your voice down," Fish said. "Anybody in here could be a spy. And we don't get any word out. You heard of anybody offering to buy anything?"
"No," Tully admitted. "But that's because..."
"Because most of them know they can be outbid. You notice the twins aren't offering anything? They figure they can get what they want by divine right or something."
"Yeah, but..."
"You have no grasp of the situation, Tully. Let me offer you a challenge."
"I'm fed up with your shit, Fish."
"Indulge me in an experiment. If I'm wrong, I'll shout it from the rooftops. If I'm right, you win anyway."
"Yeah? Let's hear it."
Sucked him up again, Smeds thought. His opinion of his cousin declined by the hour. "Here's two coppers. Go find a kid somewhere away from here. One who don't know you. Pay him to go to the Toad and Rose and tell the bullies there that the wizard Nathan is looking to hire a couple of men to help him sneak out of the city tomorrow morning."
"I don't get it,"
Smed said.
"Gods, Tully. Couldn't you just once do something without arguing about it first?"
Fish said, "The experiment will be more instructive if it simply unfolds, explaining itself as it goes."
"Why should I do that asshole Nathan any favors?"
Smed stood up.
"I'll do it.
Otherwise we'll be here till the middle of next week. I want Tully to do it. I want him to see that there can be a direct connection between his saying something and what happens in the real world."
"You're putting me down again, ain't you?"
"Tully," Smed said, "shut the fuck up or I'm going to brain you. Pick up the goddamned money, hit the goddamn street, find a kid and pay him to deliver the goddamned message. Now!" Tully went. Smed's had gotten pretty intense.
"He's going to get us all killed,"
Timmy said as soon as he was gone.
"How's your hand coming?"
Smeds asked.
"Real good. Don't try to distract me, Smeds."
"Easy, Timmy," Fish said. "I think there's a chance this trick will get through to him."
"Wanna bet?"
"No." Smeds wouldn't have taken the bet either. The wizard Nathan and his four men had rented rooms just up the street from the Skull and Crossbones. The Greys came there shortly before dawn. They found five dead men and two rooms torn to shreds. They sealed the area, searched it again, asked a lot of questions. Fish made sure they all got a good look at the mess. He asked Tully,
"You starting to catch on?"
"Who would do something like that, man? Why?"
"Nathan was a wizard. If he was going to sneak, that meant he'd found the spike and wanted to make a run for it.
But he wasn't going to leave town.
No, he wasn't, Tully. But you said he was. Tully started to be Tully and argue, but he bit down on it and thought for a moment before he said,
Oh.
Next time you say something without thinking first or checking to see who's listening, that could be us all carved up. Smed said,
You maybe went too far to make your point, Fish.
Why?
This ain't over yet. Those soldiers didn't find anything but a mess. They're going to figure whoever made the mess got the spike.
Yeah? And maybe everybody else will think so, too. Maybe even the guys who actually did it. The next few days ought to be interesting, and part of the ongoing lesson.
What are you blathering now?
Tully demanded. That was a big gang in that place, eh? 5 pro thugs and a sorcerer. Nobody would try to take them alone. I figure there was at least 3 guys did it, probably more. Unless they're a bunch that really trust each other, they're going to have trouble. Every one of them is going to know he didn't get the spike, but he isn't going to be sure about the others. Tully said,
Oh, again,
and after a while,
This shit is getting scary. I never thought it would get this hairy.
Your problem is you never thought,
Timmy muttered, but Tully didn't hear him. Fish said, It's just starting, Tully. It's going to get hairier. And if we want to come out of it with our skins on, we're going to have to be very damned careful. These aren't nice or reasonable people. They aren't going to be interested in dealing till they got no other choice. It got hairier fast as more and more powerful thaumaturgic treasure hunters poured into the city. Old feuds having nothing to do with the spike flared. The citizenry, pressed from all sides, responded by rioting on a small scale. The twins presided smugly, doing nothing to retard the escalating violence. Smed spent a lot of time being sorry he had let Tully get him into this in the first place. Because of the other treasure they had brought home, the living was good, but not good enough, given that he had to watch his every word every minute and spent half his time looking over his shoulder to make sure disaster was not gaining on him. Chapter 40 We were over the forest of clouds, south of Orr, east of Roses, west of Lords, hiding out from Imperial eyes, too many of which had seen the wind whales cruising far from their proper range over the plain of fear. Darlin wanted to let a little of the excitement die down before she moved on. She wouldn't let the tree god hurry her, though he was in a minor frenzy. I didn't understand exactly what was up yet, but neither did some of the others. So we were getting an education from old Bowman's, who was suddenly Darlin's number one boy. Since you were all there, you'll recall that in the course of the battle in the Barrowland, the soul or essence of the Dominator, the most evil being ever to walk this earth, was imprisoned in a silver spike, which was then driven into the trunk of a sapling, sired by the tree god of the Plane of Fear. He really did talk that way when he had an audience. At the time, it was believed that would effectively contain and constrain the residual evil of the man forever. The sapling was the scion of a god, invulnerable, unapproachable, and so long-lived as to be, in practical terms, immortal. As the sapling grew, its trunk would engulf the spike. In time, the old evil would not persist in so much as memory. However, we thought wrong. A band of adventurers succeeded in stunning the sapling long enough to get in and prize the spike out. If we are to credit the sapling's own testimony, and we must, for the nonce, because it is the only testimony we have, none of those men had the least familiarity with the art and were remarkable only because they came up with an idea that, logically, should have originated with someone devoted to the occult. Damn him, he did talk like that when he had an audience, and he wouldn't stop. Gentlemen, the silver spike is loose in the world. It's not the Dominator. He's dead. But the undying black essence that drove him remains. And that could be used by an adept to summon, coerce, and shape powers even I cannot begin to imagine or fathom. That spike could become a conduit to the very heart of darkness, an opener of the way that would confer upon its possessor powers perhaps exceeding even those the Dominator possessed. Our mission, our holy mission, given the white rose by Old Father Tree himself, is to recover the silver spike and deliver it for safekeeping at whatever cost to ourselves before someone of power seizes upon it and shapes it to his own dark purpose and is, in this turn, shaped. Perhaps into a shadow so deep there would be no chance ever for the world to win free. That bit about at whatever cost to ourselves got a big hand. The talking buzzard pulled his head out from under his wing, cracked an eye, went to town heckling the old wizard. That finally distracted him from his windier fancies.
Buzzard! If you were fit to eat, I'd be picking up kindling right now!
He shouted. Then he got back to business. The tree god has reason to suspect that the spike is now in ore. The White Rose, Silent, the Torx, and some of our smaller companions will drop into the city. With the help of the underground, they will establish a secure base. Then we'll take up the hunt. Raven, Case, and I, because of our considerable familiarity with the site, will go on to the Barrowland to see what can be learned there. That started a bunch of bitchin'. Raven didn't like being sent off someplace where Darlin wasn't. I didn't think these guys had the right to draft me into their adventure. I got pretty hot. Darlin took me aside and calmed me down, then convinced me that even if I remained committed to the Empire in my heart, helping her in this would not harm me. Maybe she was right when she said the evil she wanted to abort wouldn't respect allegiances or philosophies, that it would divide the world into two kinds of people, its enemies and its slaves. That was a little heavy to get down in one or two bites, but I said, all right, I'm just following Raven around anyway. Might as well keep on keeping on. So that was that. I gave in. I also started giving some thought to going back to herding potatoes as a career. No old potato never talked anybody into making a fool of himself. Chapter 41 Smeds came out onto the porch of the Skull and Crossbones, figuring to shoot the shit with Fish, but found the only empty chair stood between Fish and the Nightcrawler Corporal. He wanted to turn around, but felt like he was committed. He plopped down.
Hey, Corp! Don't you ever do nothing but sit here and drink beer?
Not if I can help it.
That's the life. I ought to go sign up.
Yeah, you wouldn't like it. Where was you at 3 a.m?
In bed, sleeping off one.
Lucky you. Ask me where I was at 3 a.m.
Where were you at 3 a.m?
With about 200 other guys out shant. where they got all those buildings torn down and nothing new put up yet. Looking for a monster? Some guy reported there was a monster out there bigger than the Civil Palace.
Was there?
Not even a little one.
Was the guy drunk?
Would a sober man be out there at that time of night? Got something interesting coming here. Fish interjected, jutting his chin up the street. Smed saw three men and a woman. She was not much to look at and too old to be interesting anyway, but she looked tough. She carried weapons like a man. As a bunch, they looked as hard and tough as any Smed had seen. But what made them stand out was the zoo they carried with them. The woman had a live ferret draped around her neck and chipmunks peeking out of her pockets. The tall, dark, and darkly clad man who walked to her right carried an unhooded falcon on his left shoulder. The three men behind them, Smets thought they might be brothers, carried a bunch of monkeys and one big snake. Smets asked, "You going to arrest them? They're lugging enough illegal hardware to start their own war." "And give you boys a show?" "Huh?" "My mama's stupid babies never lived to make corporal." Even so, he stuck his fingers in this mouth and whistled. When those people looked, he beckoned. The tall man looked over with tight eyes for a moment, made a slight gesture at the man with the snake. That one came over. The snake looked them over like it was sizing them up for dinner. It gave Smedge the creeps. The corporal said, "Just a friendly word of advice, pal. The city is under martial law. Ain't nobody supposed to tote a blade over 8 inches long. Unless he's wearing gray." The snake man went back and told the tall man, who looked at the corporal hard for a moment, then nodded.
"You see that?" Smed said. "That goddamned monkey gave us the finger."
The corporal said, "I seen that tall guy somewhere before. Down the length of a sword."
Well,
bucket's empty. Save my chair while I walk my lizard and get me a refill." He went inside.
"What you think of that bunch?"
Smeds asked Fish. "I've seen the tall one before, too. In the same circumstances as the corporal. A long time ago. No problem remembering where or when either, since I was only ever in one battle." That just puzzled Smeds. He asked,
"You figure they're here after the dingus, too?"
He could ask because by now, everyone in town had a good idea what was going on. "They're here for it, yes. They'll help make the game interesting."
"What are you yapping about, Fish?"
"Don't mind me, boy. Just an old man, maundering."
"Ha! I thought so.
Isn't there any more, is it?"
Down the street, the animals people had stopped in front of a place Timmy said used to be a butcher shop, but these days was just another dump filled up with squatters. The tall man glanced back as though he had heard Fish. Then the whole bunch moved on, indifferent to stares. The corporal came back out with his full pail and bladder empty.
"I ought to give this shit up. Bothers my stomach."
He took a drink.
"Where were we?"
Fish said, "I was just going to ask you when they're going to unbutton the gates. Going to start getting hungry in here now the farmers won't bring anything in."
"They don't consult me on policy, Pop. But I'll tell you something. I don't think those two bitches give a rat's ass if everybody in North starves.
They ain't going to go hungry." Smets was tired of listening to the corporal.
"Going to get me something to drink."
He went inside and had a beer drawn, wondered how long the supply would last, and how much more patience the people of Orr had. A while, for sure. Not that many were hurting, yet. But if circumstances did not change, a big blow-up was inevitable. Timmy Loken came in, got him a beer, stood beside Smeds a while without saying anything, then suggested,
"Let's go for a walk when we finish these."
"All right. I need the exercise." When they were well away from the Skull and Crossbones, passing through a construction area where they were unlikely to be overheard, Smeds asked,
"Well, what's up?" "You remember that doc that looked at my hand when we first came back?"
"Yeah." More than a twinge of guilt. He and Fish had not told the others what they had done. Tully was so indifferent, he had not noticed that the physician and wizard were no longer among the living. Timmy had noticed, though, and Smed supposed he had some definite suspicions about two such coincidental and convenient murders.
"What about him?"
"It looks like he got whatever it was that I had and passed it around to everybody who came to see him. And they passed it on, too. Not like the plague, or probably everybody would have it by now, but there's a couple hundred people got it already. The ones that have had it the longest? Well, they're worse off than I was. Yesterday, a woman who had it killed herself. This morning, a guy whose whole arm had gone black killed four of his kids who had it before he killed himself."
"That's awful. That's really gruesome. But it isn't anything we can do anything about."
"I know that. But the thing is, see, the Greys have gotten interested. They're grilling everybody with the black stuff. From the questions they're asking, you can tell they think there's a connection with the spike. They're trying real hard to find out about everybody who's had it and done something about it, like me."
"I don't think you need to worry, Timmy. They can't trace it back to you."
"Yeah? Those bitches are serious, Smits? What happens after they find out all the trails lead back to that doc who turned up among the dead right after the stuff started spreading? They're going to figure he had a fatal accident on account of somebody he treated didn't want to be remembered. And they already know the only way to treat the stuff is to cut off whatever it's eaten on. So pretty soon the word goes out to the Greys to grab amputees. Especially guys with missing hands."
"Maybe you got a point. Maybe we better see what Fish thinks." Fish agreed with Timmy. There was no reason to think Gossamer and Spider Silk would not go so far as to order the arrest of all amputees. They were determined. Fish did some heavy thinking. "I reckon it's time to blow some smoke."
"What do you mean?" Smeds asked.
"The situation. The whole city sealed up like a bottle can't go on forever. There'll be a blow-up. When that comes, we break loose with everybody else. Till then, we buy time by getting them off on a wild goose chase, or by taking advantage of the potential